ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
इति देवान् समादिश्य भगवान् पुरुषोत्तमा तेषाम् अन्तारदधे राजन् स्वच्छन्दगत्यर ईश्वरा. Shukadev Goswami continued, O King Parikshit, after advising the demigods in this way, the independent supreme personality of Godhead, the best of all living entities, disappeared from their presence. Tathasmoi bhagavate namaskritya pitamaha bhavascha jagmathu swam swam dhamo peyur balim sura. Then Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, after offering their respectful obeisances to the Lord, returned to their abodes. All the demigods then approached Bali Maharaj. Dristvarin apyasam yatan jata kshobhan sunayakan yashidha doitya rat shlokya sandhi vigraha khalavit. Bali Maharaj, a most celebrated king of the demons, knew very well when to make peace and when to fight. Thus, although his commanders and captains were agitated and were about to kill the demigods, Maharaj Bali, seeing that the demigods were coming to him without a militant attitude, forbade his commanders to kill them. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Vedic etiquette enjoins, Grihe satrum api praptam vishvastham akuto bhayam. When enemies come to their opponent's place, they should be received in such a way that they will forget that there is animosity between the two parties. Bali Maharaj was well conversant with the art of peacemaking and fighting. Thus he received the demigods very well. Although his commanders and captains were agitated, this kind of treatment was prevalent even during the fight between the Pandavas and the Kurus. During the day, the Pandavas and Kurus would fight with the utmost strength, and then the day was over, they would go to each other's camps as friends and be received as such. During such friendly meetings, one enemy would offer anything the other enemy wanted. That was the system. Translation. Maharaj Bali, a most celebrated king of the demons, knew very well when to make peace and when to fight. Thus, although his commanders and captains were agitated and were about to kill the demigods, Maharaj Bali, seeing that the demigods were coming to him without a militant attitude, forbade his commanders to kill them. Krishna tells in the Gita that for a kshatriya, dishonor is worse than death. And in the great Vedic histories, we find this most highly esteemed quality in many, many great rulers of the world. Such great souls as Maharaj Shibi, Maharaj Yudhisthira, Bhishma Dev, even Duryodhana, powerful kings who understood the great importance of dealing in the battlefield and amongst their subjects with a high sense of honor. Of course, this sentiment is practically lost as Kali Yuga progresses. The battles today are fought least in the battlefield. In the battlefield of Kurukshetra, and even in regard to this great battle between the demigods and the demons, we find that those who are fighting will fight with a very, very high sense of honor. They will only fight with someone who is equally matched, who has equal weapons. And for them to die in such a battle is far more glorious and desirable than to live on the battlefield as a cheater and losing one's sense of honor. If you look at the wars going on over the past 20 or 30 years, most of it is based on the principle of terrorism, which is the most utterly dishonorable act of conduct for one who is in the Kshatriya role. During the Vietnam War, most of the killing was not done soldiers facing one another and shooting, but rather they would plant various traps. People would be hiding in the jungles, and they'd put bombs on the road, and they'd have their detonators, and one person would be there, and then a troop of several hundred soldiers would come walking, and the person in the bushes would simply press the electrical charge of the detonator, and the bombs would go off and all the soldiers would be killed. Unexpecting, unarmed, not even a fight. Or they would put various bamboo shoots in the ground. The person would step on it and his leg would be all torn up, and then when they would be laying there in pain, people would just come out of the bushes with guns and shoot them dead. This is how most of the killing was done. Or when somebody was sleeping, some spy would secretly plant different bombs under the different buildings, and then someone would push the button and everything would blow up. And as those who survived, as they were running away, there would be people in the bushes who couldn't even see shooting them, all dead. What to speak of the innocent civilians? They would come into villages and burn the entire village down. Thinking there might be a spy within the village, they would kill entire villages of people. We see in the Battle of Kurukshetra that there wasn't a particular civilian who was even the slightest bit involved. It was only the great warriors who assembled in a place completely away from any of the common people of society. And the war was between them. No one else was involved. And they agreed on terms before the war. and they all agree on the unwritten law of Kshatriya honor. Of course, at the end of the Battle of Kurukshetra, Adharma became very prevalent. And Ashwatthama, we read what he had done, while all the survivors of the war in the Pandava army, save and except the five Pandavas, Krishna, Satyaki, and a few others, they had gone to Hastinapur. The others, being very much tired from fighting day and night, were sleeping. At that time, Ashwatthama, Kritavarma, and Kripacharya killed them all in their sleep. And this was considered the most utterly dishonorable and disgraceful activity for a Kshatriya. And this incident was so disgraceful, was so utterly dishonorable, that even to this day, 5,000 years ago, we cannot forget it, because such things were unheard of in the days of the real Kshatriya kings. But today, the wars that are going on, this is all they do. Political parties plant bombs and airplanes to murder innocent people just to prove their political position. They plant bombs in buses, they plant bombs in trains, they plant bombs in movie theaters. This way, people who have nothing to do with anything, women, children, old men and ladies, they're destroyed, they're killed, they're wounded for life. So we find that as Kali Yuga progresses, the sense of truthfulness, which is the last leg of religion within this age, is dwindling day by day. Austerity, mercy, cleanliness, and truthfulness. These are the four legs of Dharma. And in Kali Yuga, only one remains. That is truthfulness. And as we see, that is becoming weaker and weaker and weaker. But here we find Bali Maharaj, although he was king of the demons, the Asuras, even so, as a Kshatriya, he had a very, very high sense of honor. The demigods came to his place, and they came in a peaceful state with a desire to make peace. Now, of course, Bali Maharaj's associates, they were thinking that this is a perfect opportunity to get rid of these demigods once and for all. They do not have a chance. They are in our camp. We could slaughter them all right now and never have to see their faces again. But Bali Maharaj forbade them to do so. Because for Bali Maharaj, dishonor was worse than death. For Bali Maharaj, truth was higher than any other acquisition that one can attain in this world. Later on in the story, we find, toward the end of this beautiful narration, that Bali Maharaj ultimately defeats all the demigods in battle. And ultimately, the demigods have no one else to turn to except Krishna. At that time, Krishna appears as Lord Vamanadeva. And for the sake of protecting his devotees, just see what the Lord is willing to undergo The Lord is willing to take the position of a beggar. Why would God beg anything from anyone? He is the proprietor of everything that exists. Sarva Loka Maheshwara. Everything is the property of Krishna. He is the supreme controller. It is He who is the source of Brahma, Vishnu, Maheshwar. We read in the Srimad Bhagavatam of how Lord Brahma creates the entire universe that we are living with such miraculous powers. We read of how Lord Narayan is maintaining everything perfectly. And we read of how Lord Shankar, in his form of Rudra, destroys the entire cosmic creation. Such potencies can never be acquired by an ordinary man. Our scientists and many of our political leaders in this world are very proud of the great power that they have acquired through their good intelligence by building big, big bombs. But with all of their biggest bombs, they will never have the power to even destroy this tiny little Earth planet. By the arrangement of nature, they will destroy themselves before they'll be able to destroy the Earth. They could cause great imbalance in the Earth. That they have the power. But ultimately, it is they that suffer due to the imbalances of the Earth, due to exploitation, that they cannot destroy. Because the Earth is very ancient, very old, and will live a long time. And all these big, big egomaniacs that are creating all these grand plans for destruction, they will cause some scars in the Earth, their own mother, and ultimately, because they're utterly depending on her for their survival, they will all die because she will no longer provide for them what is required. And after their whole civilization dies off, gradually the Earth will heal itself, come back to its perfect and normal state. So for the Mother Earth, she's just saying, all these crazy rascals, just coming and going, coming and going, coming and going, killing one another. They cannot destroy the Earth. With all of their devices and all their grand, grand plans and all their nuclear bombs and radiation and so on and so forth, they cannot harm practically even this own Earth. Whatever harm they inflict upon the Mother ultimately are only harming themselves. Mother Earth will survive and go on. But Lord Shiva, when he gets the indication from Narayan, he has the potency to destroy all the universe. That is his infinite power. And we read in Bhagavatam how the great creator, Lord Brahma, after he stole the calves and the cowherd boys from Sri Krishna, when Krishna expanded himself to reveal his divine opulence, Lord Brahma, in utter humility, had to fall at the feet of Lord Krishna, beg for forgiveness and surrender. That before you, my Lord, all of my power to create is insignificant. And we also read in the 10th canto of Lord Shiva how sometimes he is put in such a dangerous situation by giving benedictions to demons like Brikasura. And those demons come back to him to kill him. How he was running for his life. And ultimately, he had to take shelter of Lord Narayan to save him. Although Lord Shiva is the destroyer of all destroyers in this world, Brahma is the creator of all creators, Shiva is the destroyer of all destroyers. Even Shiva, on a practical level, he has to run to Narayan to be protected from being destroyed. And we find that all the demigods, the most powerful suppliers of all the benedictions upon humanity and all living beings in this earth, they are totally depending, like beggars, on the divine provisions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan, who is supplying all facilities for all living beings. And the same Lord Narayan, out of his love for his devotees, in order to protect them, comes to this world as a beggar, wearing the robe of a simple mendicant with a begging pot. He came before the king of the demons, Bali Maharaj, begging him for a donation. Now, of course, the profession of a beggar is the most humbling of all occupations. In fact, this is the reason why brahmacharis, sannyasis, or monks of all traditions, they are sent out to become beggars. The reason is not that they need to be provided the bare necessities of life. That has little or nothing to do with begging. It is not that they are in need, so they must beg. Because we find some of the great wealthy people of the world, even kings, they become beggars after leaving their kingdom behind. A perfect example is Gautam Buddha. Lord Buddha was a prince. His father was king. And he had vast wealth. And absolutely everything he had, his greatest desire was to just give it all over to his eldest son to enjoy. Lord Buddha was given his own beautiful, beautiful palace beyond description. It is explained in the Buddhist literatures that that the quality of the craftsmanship of this palace is such that we cannot even imagine in this day and age. And he had innumerable servants. He was given the most beautiful, beautiful, beautiful wife, who was so faithful, kind, and mild-mannered in all circumstances. He was given great power, power over the entire kingdom. His parents had only one desire, that he be satisfied with his material life and remain home. Because at his birth, one Brahmin astrologer predicted that he would renounce everything and become a mendicant. And this was unbearable thought for the parents. So they just tried to spoil him with every type of material pleasure. And they hid from him every type of material inconvenience. So he didn't even know what inconvenience was. He never even had a conception that there was such thing as suffering or pain. But then on that great and fateful chariot ride amongst the common people, when he saw suffering, when he saw old age, disease, and deaths, he felt such compassion for the fallen souls that he left everything to become a beggar. With a begging bowl, he would go from door to door. And some of the greatest scholars, some people from the highest royal families, they were giving up all their worldly connections to join Lord Buddha, and he would send them out with begging bowls to go door to door as a beggar. To be a beggar means to be insulted, to be humiliated, to be in a subordinate position of even the lowest men of mankind. To be seen by ignorant people and accused as being a parasite and somebody who's lazy. Why does such a person become a beggar? Why did Buddha send his people to be beggars? Even in the Buddhist countries today, recently I was in Thailand. In Thailand, if you go driving on a train and go through villages, even the cities, you will find every morning, every evening, just hordes and hordes of monks are just going door to door. You see them with their begging pots, people giving them some little something. Sometimes they give them nothing. And even in our own Vaishnava tradition, we find traditionally, even Rupa and Sanatan, although they were prime ministers of the King of Bengal, they renounced it all. And even though they had disciples who were willing to provide money to build beautiful temples like Madan Mohan, such unbelievable cost that must have been to build such a beautiful hand-carved stone temple. And all the money was in the control of Sanatan Goswami. And yet what did he do? He would go out with his begging bowl and beg for some dried chapatis, just to show example to us. So this begging is meant for one purpose. It is meant to humble the heart of the aspiring devotee. Sankirtan is begging. But actually a devotee feels that he's giving in begging. We're giving this person the opportunity to make spiritual progress by connecting their consciousness with Krishna. We're not begging for food. We're not begging for money. We're begging a conditioned soul to have mercy upon his own life and offer something to Krishna for his spiritual welfare. We are beggars, but we're not beggars for our sake. Externally it appears that way, but our hearts, we are actually begging a person to save himself by offering something to Krishna. There is that wonderful story that Srila Prabhupada tells of one sannyasi who was begging door to door, and he had a little food that some people had given some previous homes in his bowl, and he came to a house of very materialistic grihasta, and the man answered the door. And he stood there with his begging bowl, and the wife saw him, and she said, "This nonsense man, we work so hard for our money. This man is simply a lazy bum. Why doesn't he get a job? You want something? I'll give you a donation." She went to the kitchen and got a handful of ashes and threw it all over his food in the begging bowl and said, here's your donation. The man lit up with delight. He said, "Thank you very much. Your spiritual life has begun. You have given something for Krishna." So this is the sweetness of the beggars of the Lord. They are begging for two reasons. One, they are begging to help that person make spiritual advancement by begging them to render some service. Because after all, the disciple is simply begging on behalf of the guru. Whatever the person gives, he's actually offering service to your guru. You have no claim to anything. Just like at New Vrindavan, there's a policy that when you go on Sankirtan, you are not entitled to one penny. It is sinful to take one penny for yourself, or one paisa. When you are begging on behalf of your spiritual master, and for you to take one paisa is sinful. It's like a bank teller. When you go to a bank and you deposit 1,000 rupees, does the teller have the right to think, well, 1,000, if I take 100, it's not so bad, 900 goes to the bank? Why? Criminal activity, sinful. Such a person must be put in prison. Right? So similarly, when we go out begging on behalf of Guru, when we are doing the Sankirtan, we are like bank teller. We are simply there approaching the spiritual on behalf of Guru. We're simply begging people, engage in the service of my Guru. Make your life perfect. Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda, they would go door to door begging people, take the holy name. We are beggars begging you, take the holy name. Give something to Krishna by chanting his name. Make your life perfect. That is the mood. So in spiritual life, a beggar has two purposes. One is he is begging on behalf of Guru, begging that person to make spiritual progress by engaging in devotional service. And two, he is taking a position which is the most humbling of all professions. There's nothing more humbling than being a beggar, because it's the lowest position on the material scale of society. Now here's Lord Vamanadev, who is the protector and maintainer of Brahma and Shiva. He is taking the position of a beggar, wearing the robe of a beggar, carrying the pot of a beggar. And he is approaching a demon, Bali Maharaj, to beg. This is the love of God. This is the extent that God loves his devotees. That to help his devotees, he's even willing to take the most humiliating position, the lowest position of a beggar. And he's even willing to go and beg from a demon. Huh? This is the extent of God's love for his devotee. And we find that Bali Maharaj, who had taken a vow of charity, when Vamanadev came to beg from him, Shukracharya was saying, no, no, Bali, this is actually a cheater. This is God in disguise. He will steal everything from you. If you agree to give him these three steps of lands, he will take everything you possess. You will be left with nothing. And Bali Maharaj understood that what Shukracharya was saying was true. But his sense of honor was of such integrity that he felt, even if I lose everything, it's not as bad as losing my self-respect, as losing my truthfulness. And besides that, he told Shukracharya, if this is actually Krishna like you're saying, he is the proprietor of everything and we're supposed to surrender everything to him anyway, and the guru is supposed to tell us to surrender to Krishna, you're telling me not to surrender to Krishna, therefore you're a bogus guru, get out of my palace. Shukracharya cursed him that you will lose everything, and then he left. And Bali Maharaj knew he would lose everything. But for the sake of truth, for the sake of the honor of preserving truth, he was willing to lose everything. Even Duryodhana, who acted in so many demoniac ways against the Pandavas, during the battle of Kurukshetra, Bhishma gave him those 5 arrows to kill the Pandavas. He was simply holding those arrows till the next morning when Bhishma made a vow that these arrows will kill the Pandavas. And he knew it's true. And he knew without the Pandavas, the whole world was his. But when Arjuna came to his home, Duryodhana understood, when a guest comes to my home, I must give him whatever he wants. Arjuna asked for the 5 arrows. Duryodhana knew that this means that I cannot win this war. But he still gave him the arrows. So, of course, as devotees of the Lord, we are not kshatriyas. We are being trained by the grace of our Guru Maharaj more in the line of being Brahmins. And therefore we must know that the real honor and integrity of our life is how much we are willing to live for the truth at all costs, at any sacrifice. And Krishna explains, when you have thus learned the truth, you will know that all living beings are but part of me, and that they are in me, and that they are mine. The truth is to understand that everything is the property of Krishna, that everything is meant for Krishna's pleasure, that I am nothing but his servant, and the servant of the servant. And therefore, to live for this truth, a devotee is willing to sacrifice anything and everything. Is there any questions? Yes.
Acharya, it was told him not to give. Did he go into that pot? And his eye was broken, is it this true?
Huh?
And he was offering that lamb, the donation. He has to offer some water. I am giving donation to you. And that is, I heard that Shukracharya went into that offering pot. And his eye was blocking the water drainage.
Bhagavatam does not explain that, but in one of the other Puranas it may be stated. Yes, I cannot say. Yes? I don't understand your question.
Yes, making this food till, I mean, as time is failing.
This is candy, it is not medicine. But she gives him medicine. Is she lying? Does she ever think that she's lying? She'd be lying by telling him it is medicine, because she'd be cheating his very life. He's going to die. So we never think that we are lying or cheating on any level. We simply present things in such a way that they will benefit. We should not be thinking we are lying. Prabhupada called it transcendental trickery.
And
excuse me, is also applicable. In our own self, there is both demon and good in us. That can be applied even there. But how do you apply there? Because you can't cheat yourself. You can't make a truce with the demons in you. But even that is also in you, and it knows what you are saying.
Oh, the instructions of the spiritual master. That is all. That is our only concern. Our internal purification takes place by following the order of the spiritual master, by following the principles of sadhana bhakti. We are not concerned with these psychological analysis of the demons and the devotees within us. Beyond, we understand who they are and how they are working, and how the only way to conquer them is to hold on to the feet of the Guru by following his instruction. That's the only way. That is our only concern, and is the only process. Purification takes place through the process of surrender. Surrender means the guru speaks, the sadhu speaks, you follow. That's all. Gradually all these impurities, all these demons are removed. It's no question of making truce with the demons within you. The only question is obedience to Guru's desire. Automatically everything else takes place. The Guru may have to trick you because of your disobedience, right? But as far as you are concerned, your only salvation.